Possession crucial from this. How much longer will the referee allow? Dublin lead by a point. And there's the whistle. It's over. It's over.
We earned it by winning the last two matches on the road. And that's not going to be taken away from us.
But what I love in hurling, I love players that will never give in.
He hits it. He hits it. It's over the bar. Oh, holy Moses.
Hello and you're welcome to the latest edition of the RTE GAA podcast. I'm your host Peter Sweeney and joining us today are UCD historian and former Offaly boss Paul Rouse, Colm Keyes of the Irish Independent and RTE Online's Mikey Stafford. Today we're going to reflect on the weekend's All-Ireland Finals and a historic few days for the Dubs. We're going to start with Saturday and Dublin's five in a row. It was an incredible occasion. Paul, what's your take home from what we saw on Saturday evening in Croke Park?
I think they can lay fair claim to being the greatest Gaelic football team that that has ever been produced since the start of the Gaelic Athletic Association. It's obviously teams can't play across generations, but the sheer basic weight of numbers are in their favour, and they did something that nobody else has done, and that is the bottom line, and it allows them the claim to be the greatest team that that Gaelic football has seen. And that is a credit to them. It's a credit to how they went about it. It's a credit to how they play. To do anything other than congratulate them is off beam.
And Kerry managed eight All-Irelands. They only did a four in a row back in the 70s and 80s. Your own county, Offaly, beat them famously.
Well, it does take a great team to stop a
It does. But they won eight All-Irelands, whereas this Dublin team, quotation marks, only have seven. You still hold them higher than that?
I think it's the in a row is the key thing here. There are other great teams who have done four in a row. The Kerry team of 29 to 32, which was, I think, lays claim to be the best team that came out of Kerry. You look at Eamon Fitzmaurice, I think, made this point brilliantly in the Examiner on Monday, that team held the record until this current Dublin team for unbeaten matches consecutively. So that team was brilliant. Wexford did it in the middle of the Great War. They did it from 1915 to 1918. Kilkenny Hurlers nearly got there, but nobody managed it. All of those extraordinary teams could not manage it. And despite the weight of expectation, Dublin, who nearly came apart, it's true they nearly came apart in the drawn game, but they didn't. Despite being a player down, despite the hits that they took, they managed the last 10 minutes. And my main take home from the season is that last 10 minutes of the drawn game and the manner in which Dublin controlled themselves. You must remember that Kerry team had more or less 4 or 5 minutes after Seamus Darby's goal, when you take things in 82. They had a lot of ball and they blew up. But Dublin just found a way. And again, they found a way. And a team that finds a way again and again, it says an awful lot about them.
Colm Keyes, would you agree?
I'd agree with everything there. I think I probably consider them the greatest team even before this, because of that 36 match unbeaten run and the manner of some of their victories in that. I remember being at a league match against Cork. I think it was in the second year of that, so it was... they started in 2015. Their last defeat was against Kerry in Killarney, and they went on this run that took them through the 2015 championship. And there was a night in Croke Park in about March 2016 against Cork, when Cork went 7 or 8 points up, maybe more, and you think, this is it. And they hadn't even reached 20 games in that run yet, and they came from nowhere, driven on by James McCarthy that night. And I'll never forget his performance. I think he scored a goal. Cormac Costello was in the team that night. And they just bypassed. They just came from acceleration, just jet-heeled, went by. And I thought that night, remember thinking that night, this is such a special team. It was just, that was one memory on that run that really stood out to me. But I think in those championship moments that Paul has referenced there, and we have seen it so often, 2017, the end of the 2017 final, when Mayo went 2 points up at one stage, and Dublin go and score the next 3 points. And then Mayo get level and Killian O'Connor has that chance. And just as he's kicking it, it's announced that there's 7 minutes left. And I'm thinking, there's no chance here for Mayo. And I thought that much the same the last day when 7 minutes were announced in the drawn game. And at that stage, Kerry had scored in the 66th minute, their last point from Cillian Spillane. And for the next 12 minutes, Dublin had possession with a man less for twice as much as Kerry had. They had it for 6 minutes and 40 seconds, twice as much. Obviously, there was breaks in play as well. But to be able to do that and retain that concentration, and some of the shots they took were obviously poor shot selections, but they still held their composure. And that's the mark of this Dublin team. Now, we could argue that maybe the Kerry team, you know, 1978 to 1982, was basically the same team. This team has changed on the run. And I think the addition of Brian Howard and Con O'Callaghan especially, and obviously Niall Scully and Owen Merchant coming into that team, that's made a huge difference. I don't know would they have got over the line if it wasn't for the cavalry.
Mikey, we're talking about the new players that have come in and helped Dublin, but if you look at it, the two main men in this whole setup, Jim Gavin, 37 games unbeaten and 37-year-old goalkeeper and captain, 6-time All-Ireland winner, Stephen Cluxton. There was a sense after the match that Jim Gavin was taking a victory lap, that he might be on his way out. Stephen Cluxton could walk away now at this age as well. Might well not as well, given the sort of person that he is. Can you kind of put in context to us the role they've played in this and what you think might happen with them in 2020?
First of all, I love the idea of anyone looking at Jim Gavin from a distance and trying to figure out what's going on inside his head, because you could probably sit down with a man for 2 hours and have a conversation with him and not know what was going on inside his head. But that notwithstanding, it's really interesting with Jim Gavin, because he, as we all know, loves talking about process, etc., etc. If he practices what he preaches, then he could probably say that he could step away and someone else, be it Desi Farrell or whoever, could step in there and do the job, that the structures are in place. I don't think that's true. I think obviously Jim Gavin has something about him, and anyone who thinks that he's just kind of at the head of this and he's kind of fulfilling a role that anybody could do is just wrong, because you can't do what he's done over the last few years and do it in the kind of serene manner in which he does it without having an awful lot about you. So I really don't know, but it's interesting talking about the players he's brought in. Like that, like he has kind of this idea that it's one team. It's almost certainly not. The best tweet I saw after the match was one about Owen Merchant. He says, "The frightening thing for all the other counties is that Owen Merchant still has another year under 14. It's, it's this guy. He looks so young, and like he had this composure. Nobody could argue Conor Callaghan's probably not the most important player on that team now, along with Brian Fenton. And like these guys aren't old. Like, and they're probably going to need a couple of sticky defenders in the next year or two, but that team is regenerating, so you'd wonder whether Jim Gavin would want to hang around to see that happen, or he seems like such a level individual, and he keeps telling us how much he has going on outside of football, so maybe now's the time to go. And Cluxton, we were chatting about it earlier, I have a theory that Cluxton will hang around as long as he's going to get picked, because Dublin is his club. Although you tell me now that things are, you know, he is kind of more involved with Parnells than he was a few years ago. So maybe that theory's not there. But I get this idea that Cluxton's team is Dublin. And it's probably the same for a lot of them, because they commit so much. Their club seasons are so short each year that the Dublin team is their club. So you see the likes of Bernard Brogan hanging around as long as possible, where a player from an unsuccessful county who doesn't have the same perks. And I don't just mean financially, I mean just in terms of being a part of a team that's that successful and is that close. Why would you walk away when at 37, 38 years of age, I'm a goalkeeper, I think I can do a job for another couple of years. I'm sure he feels the same as me. I think we're in similar physical condition. I'm convinced Cluxton's not going to walk away. Gavin, I wouldn't. I'm not a betting man, but I wouldn't try to guess what's going on inside his head.
You were there in the post-match media conference column. There was a kind of different feel about it, wasn't there? He's normally quite a hard to read individual, but he actually gave a tiny bit away, I suppose you could say.
It was certainly different from any of the experiences I've had in that setting, Peter, and you've been there obviously for them too. I remember in 2013 he came in after his first victory, and one of the first things he said was, well, all the other teams are ahead of us now in terms of preparation for 2014. And it was, having been sat through Jim McGuinness the year before, I mean, he was stone-faced in his delivery, and certainly not in sync with what you would expect from a manager who has just won his first All-Ireland title. He was also critical of the referee, Joe McQuillan, that day, and he complained about the free count. So these things you don't normally associate with a winning manager. And it went on from there, and he never really showed any emotion after any of the All-Ireland wins. Even after the three in a row, it was just routine business, and that's the way it was always portrayed. But there was a definite difference in the room on Saturday night. His father actually came in with him. Now, maybe there's no significance to that. His father would be around after post-match celebrations, especially an All-Ireland final. But he gave a lot more insight than he had done in previously. For instance, he was asked about Stephen Cluxton, and he referenced Stephen and the sub-goalkeepers and the goalkeeping coach being up, and I presume it was St Clair's and DCU. They were up for 2 hours on the Monday after the drawn game, and they had a laptop out, and Stephen was looking at his footwork for the Killian Spillane goal, and he said that's what he does, that's a master of his craft. He felt he might have done better for that, and that required 2 hours the following day with his goalkeeping team, that's the replacements, and his coach, in trying to address that. And he put that out there, obviously, to present Stephen Cluxton, his captain, you know, the leader of the team in so many ways by his actions, perhaps so more so than his words. And he put that out there for an example for every other Dublin player that's coming along after him, the legacy. He also referenced Owen Merchant's goal and said that was pretty much a planned move. Not that David Moran would punch it down, but
the way the players moved out.
The way they moved out, and they created that corridor of space for somebody to come through. Now, it may have been Jack McCaffrey. If you look at the drawn game, Jack McCaffrey tears by. It's like watching an Olympic final. It's one of the pictures that maybe Info or Sportsfile might produce of runners in a sprint final going by. And you see a blur going by, and it's Jack McCaffrey off the first throw-in. And when Paul Mannion is kicking the point off his right foot, McCaffrey's actually on his way back out, being followed by David Moran. So David Moran has tracked him for that, and David Moran is tracking Owen Merchant. But there's a corridor of space this time, and the Kerry defenders have said, we're going man-to-man here. And they're looking at Owen Merchant and saying, that's not Jack McCaffrey. At any moment now, he's going to turn and give it off to someone who can score. But he goes on. He's one of the quickest Dublin players, clearly. And he accelerates through that corridor of space. And Jim says, well, we planned that. That's not something he would ever have said before. And he certainly spoke more about the backroom team, and he brought a lot of that in. The kit man, Dave Boylan, and Shane O'Hanlon, who's a selector, but also his logistics man, who he has said before he couldn't do the job without. And it's quite clear. So you just wonder, well, maybe is Shane O'Hanlon thinking of pulling away at this stage? Is Dave Boylan, some of these key components that he relies heavily on, that everything is there and everything is ready to go for a team. And Jim is obviously a very, very good coach too, as well as being a very good manager, an outstanding manager. So maybe with those parts starting to break away a little bit, and his own professional life may come into the equation. But if you were getting a sense of Saturday night, my instinct was he's preparing to go. He's different. It's different. And maybe it was just five in a row, but I felt maybe there was something more in it.
Paul, if he does decide to step away, and obviously we don't know whether he does or he doesn't, does that signal the end of anything for Dublin, or does this bandwagon just keep on rolling?
Well, what Jim Gavin now has is that accumulation of achievement, which gives you a status in a dressing room with a group of players, with everything, that is just untouchable. And if he makes a decision, that's it. It's done. Things will shift. I think it's not just Jim Gavin going. I think up to 8 players will go. If they don't go in the winter, I think they'll go over the next while. Now, what really matters, though, is these are players who are being transitioned out of the team. When the Kerry team had finished in 86 after this third All-Ireland, Kerry football went through a huge lull, because they essentially had grown old as a team, and they had introduced very few players, like Ambrose O'Donovan came in, people like that, but very few had come in. That hardcore had been there for a dozen years. And this now, for Dublin, if you think about it, it is absolutely true that Kerry have brought through some brilliant footballers. And if you take just, I think the pick of them are probably Sean O'Shea and David Clifford, who are just like extraordinary talents. But just 2 years older than them is Conor Callaghan and Brian Howard. And if you were really thinking about it, like, you'd love to have all four in your team, but if you were Dublin, would you shed Howard and O'Callaghan for what they can do for anybody around the place? And for all the talk about the full back line and the full forward line, for all of that, in my view, the game was won around the middle, as it, most games ordinarily are, last weekend. And the dominance which Dublin drew in the middle, with the exception of those 15 minutes before half time when Kerry got a foothold in the game and drove through Dublin, the effort that that took, I think, paid in the end. But for most of the game, Dublin were in control around the middle in a way that they weren't in the drawn game. Brian Fenton is a young man. There are people like Pat O'Coffey Byrne coming through, Darren Gavin coming through. These are all top quality footballers who are going to be around the place. And I think that's whether Jim Gavin stays or Jim Gavin goes, there's a renewal of players which is ominous for pretenders. Now, I don't think that, like, the cycle will end and Dublin will, the NRO will come to an end, but Dublin will not disappear the way Kerry did for a decade after the team broke up in 86. And I think there's a really interesting thing happened. Jim Gavin, from it would appear from the outside that he did give much more away in the press conference and that move, that, and he talked about that set move. Most club teams have a plan on what to do for a throw-in. The idea that a team doesn't have a plan for a throw-in. There was a brilliant thing happened in that, though. Brian Fenton stepped across Owen Merchant's marker in that after the ball broke down. He just stepped in front of him and it gave Merchant those 3 or 4 yards. And he's gone around the corner. And that around the corner run, and you're through the middle. And it's a real problem for defenders. And we can say, why didn't they close down? Why didn't they pull in? Well, you're asking Thomas Sullivan to leave Conor Callaghan. Now, ordinarily, you leave Conor Callaghan, it's a goal. You're going to leave him free 21 yards out. Now, I think Kerry defenders they'll be disappointed they didn't come in a little bit sooner than they did and just concede a point rather than get a score.
I'd agree with that, Paul. I think looking at it again from behind the goals, I think any defensive coach would want his fullback to stay. And if there's a runner, let's try and concede the point here. And I think it was poor defending, as much it was opportunism and maybe a planned move. And you're right, because even club teams do have work out on a scenario of how where we can be, because generally everyone's in position. But when you look from that shot behind the goals, the movement just as the throw-in was coming in was just, it was in sync. They went everywhere. They pulled
the whole thing
completely
wide.
You couldn't believe that, and instinctively there was man marking. They just went and never considered Merchant as a finisher, as good as it was.
And you can see why. Here's somebody who last year, I'll never forget, last year's All-Ireland final against Tyrone, Merchant made a brilliant run up the field. I thought, he's going to clip a point here. He was only maybe 25 yards out, just to the right of the goals, and any other person is having a shot. And he turned and he stopped and he popped it off. So I thought, is there an instruction there that he's not to shoot?
Some of them don't shoot. I mean, I remember Mick Fitzsimons tearing up the field in the replay in 2016. And he's coming 20 metres out, and I say, Mick Fitzsimons is going to score a point here. And he stops and he gives the ball to Bernard Brogan.
Who was blocked, I think, if I remember
correctly. Bernard Brogan was blocked. And I'm not sure that Mayo go down. They may have got a point out of that, but Mick Fitzsimons on the run could have kicked that. You won't see Michael Darren McCauley shooting for points as much,
or maybe not at all. He'll fist them more often than James McCarthy, or else he scores goals.
Well, James McCarthy,
he got a point, but more often than not, he'll lay it off as well.
You've raised an interesting point, and I just made a note of it here about the step across by Fenton. And, you know, in looking at the game again, you can see when Paul Mannion is kicking his last point, James McCarthy steps across an opponent. It's a thing for Dublin. They do it. They do it well. They disguise it well. But it's certainly something that they use to their advantage, and they bend the rules in that way, and referees don't spot it and they get away with it. But there is a lot of blocking.
Well, if you're talking about nice little tricks, Conor Callaghan's pull but not a drag down, which got him got Mick Fitzsimons a tick instead of him. But that's another one that's being clever with the rules. You're pulling a man back, but he made sure to let go of him before he hit the ground, because under the rules that's a tick, it's not a black card. So you could say he was lucky, you could say he copped onto himself, but you know, I think that's coached, and I just think They're wonderful footballers, but they're very clever.
I actually think Dublin would, as players, as a group of players, would know the rules of the playing rules of Gaelic football very well, because
Gaelic football is a cynical game, lads, and it's about playing into the edge. All the best teams do it.
Yeah, but I think the Dublin players know the rules. They actually know what's a tick, they know what's a yellow card, they know what's a black card. I think they can pretty much quote rules to referees when they're addressing them too. I think that's known as well, that they're very, very well briefed in that regard.
Isn't that why it was probably so stunning that Johnny Cooper got himself sent off in the game? I think my instinct is that it was an instinctive reaction, but I suspect that he thought he had a tick coming after his foul.
Mm.
And that's possibly why he got away with it. It was an instinctive pullback, and David Clifford worked him brilliantly. He hooshed him around the corner and he goes. But I think it should also be said, the Dublin setup deserve huge credit for how, and Johnny Cooper himself deserves immense credit for how he played in the replay, and where they positioned him, and this idea of him driving up the field. They didn't leave him exposed inside as a one-on-one marker, and they had enough about themselves. I saw people writing before the game that Dublin would definitely put Johnny Cooper back on David Clifford. I just couldn't see that happening in a million years.
I actually thought that would happen because he's Jim's on-field general. He was his 2010 under-21 All-Ireland winning captain. He trusts him so much, and he sets the tone. If you see him around the squad, he sets the tone. I genuinely thought he would put him back on it, but there you go.
I couldn't see it. Yeah. Apart from anything else, I don't think... I think Johnny Cooper missed probably 3 months earlier in the year through injury, and I don't think he's quite at it compared to where he was. And again, I think he will be better next year than he was this year. I mean, he's been phenomenal for Dublin, absolutely phenomenal in how he's played. But I give him huge credit for the replay, the way his role was redefined for him, and the way he did that. And I thought, again, they use the word humility about themselves, and anybody who knows any of the Dublin players, I only know a couple of them, and I don't know them well at all, but every one of them that who you meet, They're decent blokes, and you see them round the place, and there's this myth. I hear some people saying it at various places that they don't work or that they don't have a life outside. Jim Gavin, to his credit, absolutely lives by what he preaches, in that there is a life outside football for them.
And most of them have they jobs. Are, they have, if they have, and if they don't, they're students.
They're busy jobs, or they are students. And it's a kind of, there's a whole other, I think there's a whole other myth making which happens when there's a serious team that is just better than everybody else, and it's there flourishing, and you like to find reasons as to why this is the case, but the reality of it is they're better players and they're better prepared, and they do have natural advantages in living in a city where they train. They don't have that press of travel that, with the exception of a couple of players, live out. I suppose Ona Garra lives in Wexford, but broadly speaking, they live around the city. So there are advantages, but and they exploit their advantages. But when it comes down to it, they are the most skillful team in Gaelic football
that we've ever seen. The footballers, left and right,
look at the number of points that were kicked off left foot, and I know Paul Mannion's left footed, Dave Burns left footed, but Conor Callaghan kicked a couple of points off his left brilliantly. Jack McCaffrey kicked a point in the drawing game off his left, and so on. They're comfortable on both sides, almost all of them.
Colm, we had it was a great weekend. If you're a Dublin fan, men and women winning All-Ireland titles 5 in a row and 3 in a row. We're in an era of unprecedented dominance. How that has come to pass and what's likely to happen in the future, this has to be a concern for the GAA, would you say?
It's absolutely a concern for the GAA, and you can admire Dublin and respect their achievements and respect them as people and all of that, and I sure do. I think they're a wonderful team and they're great to watch. But if they were to win as much as people are saying, and if this run is to continue, and then it's a very serious issue. There's no doubt about it, because the inter-county structure is the GAA's greatest gift for so long. But I think it's really, really coming under pressure now. And I think there's 1.4 million people living in Dublin, projected to go up by 2035 to 1.7 million. There are vast areas of the city now where Gaelic sports are becoming the number one sports. And that's great for GAA, but when you're funneling all those into singular county teams, that leaves the rest a long, long way behind. And that's a natural advantage that can only be addressed by some very, very hard decisions in the future. I'm not saying now, let's see how it goes. Maybe they are a special team, but you've mentioned some very, very special players coming up, like for like replacements in some ways. And if it was a case that they were to win 4 or 5 of the next 6 All-Ireland titles and the ladies were to keep on winning as well, and obviously there's a swell there, Coola have won two All-Ireland club titles back to back. Maybe there's something stirring there. It's only natural that in an area of that size that is now so clued into GAA and it's become such a popular sport, and there aren't huge amount of clubs on the south side by comparison to pockets of the north side, but maybe that'll come and it'll develop more. And at that stage, you know, the captains of industry, big businesses all in, you know, it's in Dublin, it's based in Dublin. And naturally, they want to attach themselves and identify themselves with the best team in GAA, the best team in Irish sport at the moment. No question about that. So they are backed by the best of everything. And that is going to make it very, very difficult for any other county, including Kerry. And we have seen Kerry already in these two games, albeit a younger Kerry team, perhaps. But we've seen them struggle to compete now to some degree in the last day. So I think we've got to take a step back and see. But I do think over the next 5 years, if that thread of dominance continues, then very, very big issue.
The funding gets a lot of people's hackles up, and probably rightly so, because, you know, there's a disparity there. But the natural advantages, the demographics are the absolute key. And you can see the combination of intelligent funding and investment and demographics. I was talking to the chairman of Geraldine Patrick Moran's, which is a tiny club in Fox Rock, crushed between Coola and Kilmacud and all Cabinteely soccer team and all sorts of rugby clubs. And I asked, what does Dublin's success mean for a club like you? He said, if Dublin weren't successful in this era of a successful Irish and Leinster rugby team, I don't know where we'd be. But because of the coaching development fund, their development officer is Johnny McGee. So they've got an inter-county manager as their development officer, and they're one of the smaller clubs in Dublin. But the thing people kind of forget is, okay, so a certain amount of that money comes from central funds. But a very small club like Geraldine Patrick Moran still has to raise half that salary.
19 grand.
Yeah, and it's a significant amount of money. And these are the things, it's the building blocks in Dublin. It's the clubs that are independently wealthy because of who their members are, who their sponsors are, who makes up their community, the size of the communities. I genuinely think it won't happen, but if the GAA turned off the development fund tap, it would. Dublin would stutter, but they wouldn't stop. It's not like this. I'm not saying it's a runaway train, but the demographics tell you that if GAA is as popular now in Dublin as it is, and it remains this popular, you can't have one Dublin county team playing against the other counties, because it's nonsensical. It just wouldn't make sense. And Pat Gilroy made an interesting point in his interview with you, Peter, before the replay, saying, you know, our constituencies are divided up by population, regardless of county boundaries, you know, whatever it is, 400,000 per constituency or however it works out. You're kind of getting to the point now where every other county might be relatively even, but if you've got one mega power, then you have to start looking at the county structure. And that's not anti-Dublin, that's just maths.
Paul, you want to come in there?
Yeah, I'd look at this from a slightly different level. Let's take the county team out of it for a second, and let's look at the provision of games for kids in school and kids in clubs. And for that reason alone, I support the funding of GPOs all across Dublin clubs. No problem with that. Where that funding comes from is an argument, and how it is funded, we can discuss. But the idea that there is a GPO in every club and going into every school, I think it's magnificent. It opened games to people who would never ordinarily play, and none of these guys, or the great majority of these guys, will ever get to wear a Dublin jersey. And we should not lose sight of that basic fact. And people who want to talk about taking the funding away from Dublin must deal with that basic fact of the provision of games for kids in schools, often in exceptionally disadvantaged areas. I mean, we can reference certain flourishing parishes all we want, but then we can go across the north inner city, we can go to the south inner city, and how utterly essential it is, and all across West Dublin it is, to have games promotion officers there. So that's the first point. So my argument is not to do with taking funding away from Dublin. It is the increase of funding at that level to counties all across the country, and how that becomes sustainable, and how the GAA uses its resources to do that. So let's just accept that that should be done across clubs and across counties, and there should be a way to fund that. And the GAA is capable of doing so many. If the GAA can find 30 million to redevelop Páirc Uí, it can find the finances on an annual basis to help clubs around the country get their GPOs. That's the first point I make. The second point I make, the point that Colm makes about the demographics of Dublin are exceptionally well made, but I will extend that still further. It is true that there will be that it is projected there will be another million people living in Ireland in the next 20 years, and that half of that million is to be in the greater Dublin area, spilling over into Wicklow and into Kildare and into Meath and up into Loud. And that does suggest a population issue around Dublin that is going to get worse. But it's more than that. It's also the urbanisation around the countryside. So you get, for example, in County Leash, there's a brilliant document produced by Leash GAA a couple of years ago, which talked about the absolute imperative of founding another GAA club in Port Leash to cater for the number of
people.
There's
only one club in one of the biggest towns in the country.
Exactly. And then around that, there's a drift away from people who are living in rural areas, in rural parishes. And in those rural parishes, there is a decline in the number of kids per family. And it is a cycle where you see parishes who will be unable to field teams on a club basis. So this is still just talking about on a club basis. On top of that, if you want to build in urban areas, whether that's Dublin or Cork or Galway, there are huge demands on clubs to cater for the kids who are now coming through their doors. One of the hardest jobs in any Dublin club at the moment is to find fields for their teams to train on and to play on. It's a constant struggle all around this place. So there are also costs and demands in urban areas. It's not just a cash cow scenario where you can go around and get stuff from businesses and everything is fine. And I understand why people want to split Dublin. And it may very well be that things will come to the pass where that happens. But there is an identity around the Dublin football team that should not be disregarded too lightly. It means something to people in the city that there is a Dublin. And it means something to the GAA in Dublin. So you have to really tread very lightly when you do that. That's the first point I make. The second point I make is, in respect of the county structure, that if you wish to talk about splitting Dublin in order that Dublin be more competitive with everybody else, you then have to talk about putting other counties together, merging certain counties. And I would say that would be an exceptionally tricky conversation to have around the countryside. The essential point that Pat Gilroy made, and you, I think in fairness, Colm, you started with this point, that the GAA's greatest strength is its counties, and also potentially its greatest weakness.
In
the future. And you can see, equally, I would say the same for parishes. I mean, parishes are going to have to be collapsed onto each other to produce proper teams. So how do you deal with that? Well, where is the strategic vision? Where is the strategic review in all of this? We go now down the road of, you know, putting lipstick on a pig by talking about a Tier 2 championship, which is a B All-Ireland championship. To what end? For whom? Where does it fit within the broader issues of coaching, of financing and of general calendar overhaul, which means county teams are coming back training next month. Isn't that extraordinary?
Can I bring you in that column about the Tier 2 championship? The GAA appear to be rushing headlong into this. They seem determined to push this through. To my mind, it doesn't seem to solve any of the problems.
There's a parallel here in that there's a fixtures task force currently looking at this as their intent on pushing through a B championship. And I would think that once that was set up, it was maybe time to sit back and just allow that group to get on with their work. I actually think at some stage there will be tiers. I think it's inevitable. Paul mentions, where's the split? Right now we could maybe pick four splits that could possibly, and you could be looking at a Tier 1 with six teams in it, and that's the reality, because
we have five in hurling, so why not something similar?
Well, I think there's probably six teams that can compete against each other to some degree, and after that you have another eight or nine, and then there's probably two sixes or something. I, you know, obviously having it written down here, and from time to time that will change, but I do think down the line, because of the dominance of these teams, and you can even see it reflected at underage level, I think Cork will get back up in time. I think Cork will get back up into that elite group. I think Galway will probably, they're there at the moment, and I think they will probably sustain there. Mayo too, Tyrone, Donegal, Kerry. So we might be talking about 7 or 8. It's probably going to run along the lines of the league, and I do think that we will be flipping over the league and playing it in summertime. And I think one of the proposals that the task force will put out there for discussion and possibly for vote at next year's Congress will be a league-based championship in the summer. And I think they will flip it right over, because the ideal should be, in my view, should be to have every team playing on the same weekend, so that you can insert club windows into the middle of the summer. And if there's no inter-county games on a certain weekend of the summer, and everybody is compelled to go back and play with their club, and if they don't, there is some measure that doesn't allow them to go back and play with their county team the next weekend, they're not eligible. So you can insert club windows into the summer, May, June, July, August, and you can bring All-Ireland finals back to September, because club finals will be well advanced. All it takes is a bit of legislation and a lot of structural change, because we have to ask, is the provincial championships serving the GAA well now? I think it's the biggest obstacle to better, more time and fairer time, not just time at the end of the season. I would have seen it this year. I thought, and I'm involved obviously in a club in Meath, and I just saw so many players drifted away at a certain time of the year in May and June, when there was just a switch off. And there is a switch off because championships, there's no engagement with championships, and that's the key to it. And unless you're going to insert these club windows into the calendar at proper times of the year, so that there's a constant flow of meaningful club games, then I just see a bleak future for club football and hurling.
The club. Sorry, Mike, your apologies.
Sorry, just going to say, on the provincial front, the making space in the calendar is I think is a priority. But with this plan that was kind of all but rubber stamped yesterday, what really annoys me about it is this idea that you're a Division 3 or 4 team, and that's it. You're in the Tommy Murphy Cup, or whatever we want to call it, unless you reach a provincial final. I just think that's a really imperfect solution. I think if you're going to be a Tommy Murphy team, maybe you should know you're a Tommy Murphy team from the start of the year, and that's what you're aiming at, rather than having this Sam Maguire dream that is never going to happen and ends, and then you're into Tommy Murphy, and it's you know, the kind of the consolation prize. That's one way. That's one problem. Second problem is, if you're going to base it on a really imperfect provincial system, like, are the Munster Council going to be forced to have an unseeded Munster Championship, because otherwise it's grossly unfair on Clare, Waterford and Limerick that they're playing in a rigged game, whereas Sligo could get a nice draw in the Connacht Championship, find themselves in the Connacht final, and then they're in the Sam Maguire. Whereas if you're Clare or Limerick, that's far less chance of that happening, because you know you'll have to play one of the big two. There's so many issues with it I really think a modern championship has to be untangled from the provincial championship. And I know that that's a major problem for administrative issue reasons and historical reasons, I'm sure Paul could tell us about. But in this day and age, it doesn't make sense. We're no longer, fans aren't travelling to games on bicycles anymore. We don't have to have a provincial structure, as far as I can see.
And this is exactly it. The provincial structure was born out of the difficulties of travelling. That was it. It was said, let's play the counties nearer. It wasn't designed on any historic allegiance to, oh, we want to be the kings of Leinster or the kings of Ulster or wherever. It was based on the first championship was so poorly run, so many matches were abandoned, that they just basically said, okay, let's just put teams together in the draw, and then you can come out and represent each other. But that first championship actually also was played between clubs. It was champion clubs. And the All-Ireland Club Championship, you could end up in a situation here where over time, this is what happens, is it's not territory based, but it becomes club based. That it becomes not, say, you represent a county. And I'm not for 1 minute advocating that. I'm just saying that things have reached a position because of the changing nature of Irish society and where things are going. Yes, there are old allegiances, and there are really potent old allegiances there. But things are shifting now in terms of where people live and how they work and the nature of their lives, that it's not clear. It's absolutely not clear that this is sustainable anymore, or that it will prove sustainable over the next 10 or 15 years.
We'll just move on to the women's final on Sunday. Dublin completed it 3 in a row there. Record crowd of over 56,000. Unfortunately, it was a very poor game. It was only 3 scores in the entire first half. But personally, I just thought it was interesting to see that the reporting of it was that it was a poor game. In the past, it would have been more that, oh, look, there was a record crowd. Paul, would you, for example, think that that's a sign of progression in women's sport, that we're taking it on its merits now more than in the past?
Well, I think it's insulting to do it any other way. The one of the great successes of the last 50 years in Irish society is the growth of women's sport, and the idea that women treat sport. And I train an under 14 girls team, and I laugh at people who talk about how, oh, boys are more competitive than girls. It means more to boys than girls. My experience around the Dublin club scene and watching my nieces play down the country and all of that is that it's just stating the absolute obvious, that it means as much to girls as it does to boys. And by that token, you must be judged to the standard of the competition in which you're in, and you have a right to ask about, if we criticise the standard at certain men's Gaelic football matches, why wouldn't we do the same for women's Gaelic football matches? To do otherwise is to patronise in a different way than women were traditionally patronised by men when it comes to playing sport. So it's just a new form of patronising to not call it for what it is. And it was a poor game. And there were brilliant footballers on that field who did not play well for whatever reason, for its conditions. This can happen. Just as there were men in the men's final in the first day. I would say if those two teams played again on Sunday week, it would be a totally different game, and it would be a far superior game than what was there. But I would look at the bigger picture. To me, the attendance, I don't care how many people go to the All-Ireland Women's Football Final. The fact that there are 56 or whatever thousand there, great, that's fine. It doesn't interest me at all. What interests me are the number of girls who are playing football, and the number of girls in every county that are playing football. And to me, it is a superb change, and it's a credit to the Ladies Gaelic Football Association, to the manner in which they've driven sponsorships, which kind of create an aura around the game. And that, to me, that is what matters. And I think the challenge actually for the Camogie Association is becoming more and more significant. And I think the Camogie Association, you know, they probably need assistance.
They were behind in terms of, they were ahead in terms of development. They started earlier than ladies football, but they started marching them essentially. Now they're in second place.
Well, there are particular challenges involved around Camogie that are much more difficult to meet in terms of the spread of the game. Mm-hmm. It's much easier to spread women's Gaelic football than it is to spread Camogie. That's just
one of the points about the growth of especially ladies Gaelic football is the numbers are coming through in clubs so much, and the question clubs are asking is, if this continues, where are we going to put them all? And it's, I think, and there's a lot of challenges, and we've just mentioned competition challenges, and there's the creeping maybe of professionalism and all of that. To me, the biggest challenge for the GAA over the next 2 decades or more is infrastructure. Where are they going to put all the players that are coming in? And if you have GPOs in Dublin, and we've discussed GPOs bringing up the numbers in all the other counties, and if there's greater engagement, and all the signs are is that participation is up and up and up, that puts huge pressure on the GAA to help out with the provision of facilities. And that's why, and I'd probably be at odds with Paul on this, but that's why I think they need as much commercial involvement to generate that money. And that's where the money should be going as much as possible, is to try and purchase land to help clubs, because, you know, there are parts of the country where, you know, you're not going to be able to dig deep into your pocket and say, there's a few quid for the pitch. They need assistance in certain areas. There are provincial towns in Leinster where the commitment to help out a club is not as great as it is in a rural area, not even as great as it is in a city.
you know, fundraising efforts in clubs can be very, very difficult. And but where are you going to put them all? I think it's such a huge challenge, and it really it demands of the GAA to be providing more.
Is
and I
that
think
one of the reasons why the integration of the three organisations, Camogie, Ladies Football and the GAA, has been as slow as it has? Because there's fears over that sort of thing, facilities and space.
I would think Ladies Football and Camogie, and I'm not exactly certain on this, but I would think that they would want to retain their own degree of independence in some ways and autonomy. But I think in relation to access to pitches and facilities, there should be as much of a level playing field as possible. In fact, it should be a level playing field. No, not as much. It should be a level playing field.
And it's not in some clubs.
Even at this. No, it's not. Because obviously the men's teams were there first. The ladies' clubs are coming in now and looking for parity. And there's obviously a little bit of begrudgery. That happens. That's human nature. But maybe a policy should be set from the very top. And that would probably require full integration. But I think there should be parity. But, you know, as much money as the GAA can generate, I think it has to be channeled back into these clubs so that they can provide facilities. And we've mentioned Dublin and the dearth of facilities there. And that's everywhere, because clubs with two pitches are now saying, well, we need a third. And actually, we need a 4G pitch, because there's so many people using the pitch in the spring and the winter that it's cutting up and we can't use it. And that's the cycle of facilities. And to me, biggest challenge.
Paul?
I think this idea of a one club movement that where there is parity between across Camogie Ladies Football and Gaelic Football and Hurling is exactly the way to do it. But we again, there's a historical legacy here. I mean, the GAA has always stressed that it's a community-based organisation. But the reality of the GAA's existence, I know Camogie was there from 1903, and I know that Ladies Gaelic Football is 1974, and it really only got going in huge numbers from the 1990s onwards, reflecting changes in Irish society. But the GAA was not a community-based organisation for most of its history. And the reason why it wasn't is that it was open to half of the community to play, because women were essentially excluded to it beyond the traditional roles
making
of
the sandwiches and washing the jerseys
in the cliched way, or shouting on from the sidelines. So the GAA finally has the opportunity to become open to everybody, and it is happening by sheer force of numbers, and it has transformed clubs in a magnificently positive way when it's harnessed properly. And it's great to see it. But that point about facilities is exactly right, because it is 4G pitches and it is lights, and all of this does cost a lot of money. But then it is up to the organisation to prioritise its spending, and that's where the calendar of play is absolutely essential to the idea of infrastructure. Because there is no point in trying to say we're going to spend a whole lot of infrastructure if you have a county team that's training from the middle of October and it's going onwards for that, and not going to play a proper match until the end of January and then stops in the middle. But there's a whole kind of human resources infrastructure built around this behemoth where of inter-county play, where people train relentlessly for month after month after month and play maybe 9 matches, 10 matches.
10, yeah, that 9-10, that's what Johnny McGee was talking about in Game On last night. Train for 10 months for 9 matches.
How about we bring in the LGFA and take their championship structure from them as well into the GAA, and then you go some way to solve the things. You have a provincial championship that a lot of counties ignore, and you have a group-based championship, and you start to put some order on your calendar then, and then you've got space for everybody. Because I agree that as an aside, I live near one of the pitches that Coola use regularly. Like Coola don't own a single pitch. They don't even own the pitch in Dalkey. It's a municipal field. I live near one that they have in Sallynagan. And I don't know what this pitch is made of, but it's a phenomenal pitch because it's just in use all winter. Like in Dublin, the underage, they take the break during the summer so everybody can go on holiday. And they're back in now. And I never go past that pitch in the evening or the weekend, and it is not thronged with children. But I used to play against Coola, and we'd be playing against Mountain Bray Emmets. Coola have to go out to Bray to rent pitches for their Junior B football team. It's
also where they prepared to win their two All-Ireland hurling titles. It's incredible to think that the champions in the biggest city have to go to a different county.
Their
to
home pitch,
prepare.
They don't have for the hurlers' home pitch, they change in containers. They don't actually have dressing rooms. You know, so it shows you what can be achieved. But I suppose that would be they'd be a model for city clubs, I suppose you could say, Paul, because they have managed to achieve with, they have decent finances, I know, but limited resources in terms of
what Coolah have done is outstanding, absolutely outstanding. But you go across all across the city and you can see what clubs are doing in various places, and there are clubs that like there are clubs that are not getting the support that they should get. At least the one thing I will say about Coolah is that Coolah does have municipal pitches in its area. You go to somewhere like Kevin's in the north inner city, where there's not a blade of grass to play in a match. There's not one full-size playing pitch in the north inner city of Dublin. Population 90,000 people. There are 10 schools in the inner city, like primary schools. Not a blade of grass in those schools for
and
people.
And there's only one club inside north and one club south inside the canals.
And this is for the GA, absolutely structurally essential to work on these issues. These, to me, they are much more interesting issues than whether there is an A championship or a B championship or a C championship. I'm much more interested in how many people can you get to play games in a particular area and to what purpose.
Lads, I think we'll wrap it up there. We have another podcast on this subject, I think, in the future. Just going to throw out one last question to each of you very quickly before I go. It's the end of the intercounty season. We're looking forward to 2020. Who is going to win the All-Ireland Football Championship next year, Colm?
Kerry.
Mikey?
I think Wexford have a good shot in the Tommy Murphy Cup, but I think Dublin are probably going to win the All-Ireland, yeah.
And Paul?
I think it's between Dublin and Kerry. I think with Donegal, with an outside puncher's chance of taking down Kerry. But I will go with Dublin.
Fair enough. Thanks very much for that, lads. Thanks for joining us at home, and thanks to Paul Rouse, Colm Keyes and Mikey Stafford for their input today. Remember, wherever you're listening today, you can download this podcast at Apple iTunes or on Spotify. Have a great week.